I wonder if the name John Calvin is at all familiar to you. No, he's not one of the long shot contenders for the Democrat nomination for president in 2020. It's a name from history. Martin Luther, by far, has higher name recognition. But John Calvin is usually regarded as the second most significant figure in the history of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. There are Christian denominations that are said to be Calvinist after John Calvin, the Swiss Reformed Church, the Dutch Reformed Church, the Presbyterians in Scotland. But we don't use his name, Calvin, for those denominations, and so he doesn't have the name recognition that Martin Luther did. But one of Luther's points was that he was concerned that in our Catholic tradition, there seems to be an effort to earn one's salvation by doing lots of good things. And Luther wanted to insist that salvation was a supernatural good that had to be the direct gift of God. It is purely a grace, not something that we could earn by what we do. Well, Calvin, as often happens in revolutions, went Luther one better. He went one step farther down that road. And he said, well, yes, it's got to be the gift of God. There's nothing that we can do to assure our salvation or to win our salvation. So it must be the pure, and one might say arbitrary, decision of God that he will give some the grace to believe, the grace to persevere in the faith, and others not. So this doctrine of John Calvin came to be called predestinationism, because the human person could not cooperate in this by means of our free will. God simply predetermined that some would be saved and some would be lost. And there was really nothing that we could do about it. Now, this doctrine provoked a certain anxiety among those who followed Calvin, because if I believe in eternal life, in the hope of heaven, I would kind of like to be able to do something to be on the path there. So Calvin said, well, you can't do anything, but there might be clues in your present life on earth as to whether you are in God's favor or not. If you have good work habits, are thrifty, are successful, that's probably a clue that you're in God's good graces now, and you probably will be in the next life to come. So, you know, the pilgrims who came to the New World and the first Thanksgiving and all that, they were Calvinists. And part of that traditional character of New Englanders being, you know, hardworking, frugal, thrifty, that's part of that Calvinist heritage. Well, now, why am I talking about John Calvin and his doctrine? Because 1,500 years before John Calvin, there was something of that spirit in those old Pharisees in the time of the Lord, that they had the idea that if you're doing well in this world, that's a pretty good indication that God is favoring you and you are living in a way that makes you his friend and you have good things to hope for in whatever is coming next. By contrast, if you're not doing so well in this world, you must be doing something wrong. And that's a pretty good indication that you are not living in God's good graces, in friendship with him. The parable that we hear in today's gospel is addressed by the Lord to those Pharisees. And it is a precise reversal of their expectation. In the parable, of course, the rich man who has everything in this world ends up in torment. The poor beggar, Lazarus, finds joy and comfort in the bosom of Abraham. The Lord is precisely shooting a flaming arrow into the middle of this idea that prosperity in this world reflects living in God's good graces. And that helps to explain some of the peculiarities about this parable. At the beginning, we hear that, you know, the rich man is dining sumptuously and Lazarus would love to have scraps from the table, but no one does anything to help him. We can understand that. You know, the rich man is neglecting. Lazarus is complacent. But when Father Abraham pronounces the judgment, he doesn't make any reference to that. He doesn't say you should have been charitable to the poor beggar Lazarus. All Father Abraham talks about is the reversal. In this life, you had everything. Now you're in torment. In this life, Lazarus suffered every kind of difficulty. Now he has found relief. It's not usually the way we think about judgment. There's no reference to the neglect of the rich man, nor is there any reference to any virtue on the part of Lazarus. You know that Lazarus prayed for the rich man even though he neglected him, that Lazarus was very patient in his suffering. Nothing like that. No virtue whatsoever, only poverty. So all you've got is the reversal. The reason for that is that the particular, as far as we can tell, the particular reason the Lord tells this parable is to explode that presumption that wealth means living in God's grace. Poverty means being less than you ought to be. As Catholics, I think we don't very much fall into that trap. I think we do have a sense that across the spectrum of relative wealth and people of limited means, across that whole spectrum, there are those who are great disciples of the Lord and those who are not. It's true, of course, that wealth can be a temptation because when someone really has a great surplus of the things of this world, there is a temptation to say, this is as good as it's ever going to get. This is the life that I fully embrace. This is what I want to enjoy for as long as I can enjoy it. Also a temptation to say, I'm set. I don't need anybody. I can take care of myself. I've got piles of money. And it's very prudently invested for every possible development in the market. I can take care of myself. Wealth is a temptation. But there are, of course, great believers and disciples of the Lord who have a lot. just as there are many people of very modest means who are the Lord's good friends as well. We might say that if somebody is a disciple of the Lord, it's unlikely that that person is at the very top of the richest people in the world. Because if someone is a good disciple, there are other things that demand that person's attention that are not just being as efficient as possible and piling up the things of this world, most notably one's family. The person is going to make decisions in the course of his or her life that means I will chase that income a little less so that I can be a little more focused on those persons whom the Lord has given me in this world. Also, if somebody is a disciple of the Lord, the way that person treats employees, clients, customers, whomever is the source of the income, that will be different. That person who is a disciple will not be trying to get the last nickel for him or herself. There will be a generosity about the way that interactions take place. And also, of course, the needs of the community and the works of God will attract part of that wealth, will be expended on that. So someone who's a disciple of the Lord won't be the very richest person. Chances are won't be the very poorest person either. Because, you know, especially in our society, the way it's structured, there are many helps for those who are in difficulty. And you really have to make a lot of bad decisions or have really, unique personal experiences not to be able to live with a modicum of dignity in this society. So the very worst destitution will probably not have many good friends of the Lord there either. But there's a great, great spectrum between those two extremes, where there are those who are good disciples of the Lord and those who are not. It is a question for us of where our hearts lie, what we do with the various gifts, talents, treasures, etc., that the Lord has given us. Part of that is certainly the relief of those who are in genuine need, who have less than we do. There's something else interesting about this parable. You know, many times today when people talk about poverty and those in need, the conversation quickly turns to the structures that need to be changed or abolished or reformed. That if you're really serious about the problems of poverty, you will be insisting that Congress acts to do one thing or another. Well, not much interest in that in the parable the Lord tells in the gospel. It's really about the rich man personally, himself, not noticing the poor man Lazarus, the particular person in his immediate field of vision who is at his door. Christian charity doesn't have so much to do with agitating about structures. It has everything to do with what I, as a person, do for the person whom I see in some need. Many of you, I hope almost everyone, remembers the great Saint Teresa of Calcutta. Most of you were alive, I think, when she was alive. Time gets away from me a little bit, but it's not that long ago. Mother Teresa, you know, is the tremendous saint and friend of the poor during the 20th century, latter part of the 20th century. And I was scandalized, I must say, during her lifetime, when some not only criticized her, but really vilified her for the emphasis she put on direct service to pick up those who were dying in the streets of Calcutta. They said, no, no, that's all wrong. If you're serious about poverty, you would change those structures that ended up with people in that situation. And they, very few, really seemed to despise Mother Teresa because her ideal was that Christian charity that goes from the person to the particular person who is in need. I quote Mother Teresa on one other point to conclude. When she visited the United States, she made the observation that there was great poverty here. She wasn't talking about what she saw in the material poverty in the streets. That wasn't nearly as bad during her lifetime as it is today. But she said, in the United States, there is a greater spiritual poverty than I encounter almost anywhere else. The loss of charity, of the connection between persons, even within families. And of course, Mother Teresa was a great friend of the unborn. And so she took that, the attack on one's own flesh and blood in the womb, as the manifestation of the greatest poverty that she saw anywhere in the world, in the human spirit. So Mother Teresa reminds us that poverty is not just material. It is also spiritual. When we look around at those who are in our immediate field of vision, those who are with us day by day, as the beggar was at the gates of the rich man, we will probably see greater spiritual poverty than material poverty. And that also is meant to have a claim on our hearts, on our generosity, to help those who do not know the true God, who have been so misled about so many things. The nature even of the human person, that to bring the truth and the hope of the gospel to those who are in spiritual poverty is a great, great work. So we offer the Eucharist today. We ask the Lord to keep us mindful of the many gifts that he has given us and to make us good stewards of those gifts, to do the good work that the Lord puts before us, especially in terms of those who are closest to us.